Welcome to the Moss Island Sounds Podcast, Episode 2. I'm Chris Board. We're sponsored this week by Finelli Sound and Lighting, a Utica, New York production company that can help with your live sound and stage lighting needs. Joe Finelli is who I call when I need something, and you should too. Email me through the Moss Island Sounds website, mossislandsounds.com, and I'll get you Joe's contact information. I used to work for a computer company. Now, I got into computers pretty late, not until Windows 95 came out. I started working for the company in November 1999, just before Y2K was set to wreak havoc on our computing infrastructure. The company I worked for sold a Y2K readiness package, which consisted of us, the technicians, inserting a disk that anybody could have gotten directly from Microsoft, running a program from that disk and playing blackjack on our Palm Pilots for 20 minutes before moving on to the next computer. $100, out of which I got maybe $6. Huge ripoff. I work with a young guy who liked to show off his technical skills. He didn't like to use the disks we brought with us. Instead, he downloaded the software from an FTP server he ran at his house. He'd open the command prompt, type a few commands, and there it was. Why do you have an FTP server at your house? There seemed no practical reason. He said, because I can. You probably know where this is going.
We know about the secret military tribunals, the secret White House email accounts. It is a stunning record of secrecy and corruption.
Hillary Clinton has been in the news this week because while she was Secretary of State, she ran an email server out of her house, conducted all of her official business on that server. When I first heard that she hadn't used her official government email account, my reaction was, it's not a big deal. After all, others have done it. But she actually registered a domain name and set up a physical email server at her house. I don't think she did it. She hired somebody. Probably my old FTP colleague. And you have to laugh because some commentators have said it was safer than using a government email account because the Secret Service guards her house and they'd stop people from breaking into her server. Because everyone knows that hackers need to actually be sitting at the computer to do real damage. Who goes to the trouble of buying and setting up their own email server when their job already provides email, and moreover, the job mandates retention of your email correspondence by law? A spokesperson said that Mrs. Clinton fully expected that anybody she sent email to would keep copies, thereby fulfilling the requirements of the law. Bull. This is going to hurt her. And it follows on the heels of her statements last year about how Edward Snowden should have worked through the federal whistleblower system. As a long-term government office holder, she should have known that whistleblower laws didn't apply to Snowden, who was a contractor. And if she did know, she assumed her audience didn't know, which is troubling in a different way. Email server at your house. There was a reason. The number one movie at the box office last weekend was the new Will Smith thriller Focus, about a con man who meets a beautiful woman and loses his focus. There was nothing original or inspired about this movie. Not even the title is original. This is the fourth movie to be called Focus since 2001. And the movie's sexual politics are just so tired by now. Have you heard of the Bechdel test? Basically, this asks if a work of fiction has two named female characters who talk to each other about something other than a man. Needless to say, Focus doesn't come close to passing the Bechdel test. Or the maybe I'll just wait and see it on Netflix test. But it did have me thinking about how something like this gets made in Hollywood today. Focus was written and directed by two men, Glenn Ficarra and John Requa. I imagine the conversation that might have happened between them. In fact, I'm fairly certain it happened exactly this way.
Dude, let's write a screenplay.
Definitely. How hard could that be?
Ooh, you know what movie I loved? That ocean thing with Clooney and Brad Pitt.
Way too confusing, bro. And we don't know anything about scams and stuff. Let's do a movie about race cars, like that Tom Cruise one.
Hey, a scam movie with Tom Cruise and race cars.
But not too confusing.
We can explain everything. Like, we'll have the characters talk about whatever scam they just did.
And we need some totally hot babe. Ooh, I just wrote our first dialogue.
Read it, brah.
Are you hitting that? Because I'd be hitting that.
Man, that's good. Okay, so we got Tom Cruise as like the super cool scam guy.
A legendary scam guy. Like, he's the best.
And the hottie wants to get a piece of the action.
I see what you did there.
So he teaches her how to scam.
And she turns out to be better than him.
Because he's totally fallen for her.
Dude, get this. He loses his focus.
That's the title. That's the name of the movie. You're a genius.
Okay, we gotta keep using that word in the script so the audience gets it. Like, you gotta keep your focus to do a good scam.
So good. I can't believe nobody's ever thought of this before.
And like, maybe she helps him find a new focus.
Because she's a total hottie.
Right?
Okay, and like, there's a whole team of scam guys, like in the Ocean movie.
And they're cool, but not as cool as Tom Cruise.
And they all want to hit the hottie.
But, like, she doesn't want them
because not Tom Cruise.
Nah, dude, you got to be creative.
Okay, because one of them is really fat.
Good, and maybe one has glasses.
And another guy says gross stuff.
Man, it's easier than I thought to write a screenplay.
Ooh, dude, total inspiration here. Tom Cruise is all hung up about his dad, who's an even more famous scam guy.
I like where this is going. And he tells the hottie about his dad, which proves he's really into her because he doesn't talk about personal stuff.
Right. Put that in the dialogue so nobody misses the point.
Already did. And then the dad shows up, but you don't know it's him.
Hold on. We'd tell people eventually, right? Because I'm getting confused.
Oh, yeah. We'll explain it 2 or 3 times so everyone gets it.
Dude, you know what song we gotta use? That Stone song about the devil.
Totally. I can't believe that song isn't used more.
We'll use it twice.
Later.
Dude, bad news. Tom Cruise can't do the movie. But they said Will Smith is available.
Isn't he black?
I think so. But it's no big deal. This is like a totally enlightened script.
Yeah, it's not like a super cool scam guy can't be black.
As long as the hottie is white.
You read my mind.
Bro, I just had a thought.
Lay it on me, brah.
Let's direct.
Definitely. How hard could it be?
A few weeks ago, I was overjoyed to learn that Bruce Springsteen had released another concert from the vaults. Springsteen hooked up with Nugs.net near the end of 2014 and released 2 stellar concerts within a few weeks' time. Rolling Stone gave a 5-star review to the Agora Cleveland 1978, saying, "This is simply the greatest live LP this greatest of live rockers has ever officially released." I agreed until now.
Teardrops on the city. Bad school.
The latest release is from Tower Theater in Upper Darby, Pennsylvania. The show was recorded on New Year's Eve, the final performance of the Born to Run tour. We've had Hammersmith Odeon, London 1975, which had been recorded 6 weeks earlier in November, for almost 10 years now, since the 30th anniversary of the Born to Run album. That was a stellar document, but Tower Theater's better. So much freaking better. I've never heard the slowed-down version of 10th Avenue Freeze-Out Springsteen does here. It's a stunner, even more so knowing that he's been performing the song for the past 2 years as tribute to saxophone player Clarence Clemons, now deceased. When Springsteen gave the keynote address at South by Southwest in 2012, he cited the Animals as his primary influence.
It's my life. I'll do what I want, you know. They were cruel. They were cruel. Which was so freeing. It was so freeing.
His rendition of the Animals' It's My Life in this concert is astonishing. Born to Run is the 8th song in the set, an overworked encore since forever. But on this recording, it's fresh and vital, new and so fast. It runs a brisk 4 minutes. Other rarities include Pretty Flamingo, written by Mark Barkin, with a long spoken introduction, musically the same as the E Street Shuffle intro from Hammersmith Odeon. Harold Dorman's Mountain of Love, and an encore that includes Detroit Medley, Quarter to Three, Thunder Road, and Twist and Shout. Springsteen likes to say lately that his band has never been better. Certainly, they can play almost anything now, and there's something exciting about throwing away the set list night after night. Today's band is everything he always wanted, a full horn section, violin, three dedicated backup singers. But his 1975 band was a lean six plus himself. If he says that they've never been playing better than now, it may be true. But there's something undeniably thrilling about the 26-year-old Bruce traveling around the country in a packed cargo van, going for broke in the name of rock and roll salvation. He left it all on the stage, and this recording proves it. Essential listening.
Now, 38% of high school students are college ready. 38%. 98.7% of high school teachers are rated effective. How can that be? How can 38% of the students be ready, but 98% of the teachers effective? 31% of third to eighth graders are proficient in English. But 99% of the teachers are rated effective. 35% of third to eighth graders proficient in math. 98% of the teachers rated effective. Who are we kidding, my friends? The problem is clear and the solution is clear. We need real, accurate, fair teacher evaluations.
New York Governor Andrew M. Cuomo, 2015 State of the State Address. That makes sense, right? Like a master illusionist, Governor Cuomo arranges the facts and the audience sees just what he wants them to see. I wrote about this issue last week, pared it down to a few essential points. Today, the rest of the story. Look at what the governor would have us believe. The teachers are responsible for student proficiency. We know it isn't true. When my daughter brings home a good report card, she gets the credit and the five spot. When she makes honor roll, I don't congratulate her teachers for their work. I know the bulk of my daughter's learning is her responsibility. Her teachers outline what needs to be learned, point the way, correct her when she veers off course. They are guides, not knowledge delivery systems. My daughter could have the best teachers and still wouldn't become proficient if she didn't attend class, remain attentive, do her homework, and if I didn't support her with encouragement, food, shelter, security, etc. The teacher is a relatively small, although crucial, part of the formula. Medical professionals know that good health comes from proper nutrition, regular exercise, enough sleep. Doctors are not expected to ensure their patients' well-being in the absence of these prerequisites. Sociologists know that low crime tracks with socioeconomic factors and is affected by positive community involvement. Police are not expected to guarantee zero crime on their own. Okay, yes, sometimes they are expected to work that miracle, usually by politicians. If my home burns down, I can't blame the fire department. I should have taken care of the faulty wiring and changed batteries in my smoke detectors. And is it the director's fault if the actors don't know their lines? I understand the union's issue. They don't want anyone fired, Governor Cuomo has said. I want to evaluate teachers, and I want to be able to get bad teachers out of the classroom. School board superintendents, principals, and teacher advocacy groups don't want bad teachers any more than the governor does. Bad teachers are already being removed from the classroom, which might be why those who remain are rated effective. The current system works. Do we really want the state to evaluate our teachers? Using tests that most education professionals say aren't good evaluation tools to begin with? Who will even want to enter the teaching profession under those conditions? activists would have us opt out of state tests. They say it will send a message, and of course it will. But opting out is not the best solution. What message do kids get from that? And what about the kids who end up taking the tests, including my daughter? If there's going to be civil disobedience, I'd rather have my entire school district opt out. Don't offer the tests at all. Now, that might cause short-term difficulty if it costs us state funding. We'd have to be prepared to make up the shortfall. But kids would benefit immediately. No more practice drills, no more teaching to the test. And once other districts follow suit, systematic change would follow. Maybe you're asking, isn't there an education crisis to deal with? Maybe. Of course, we're calling it a crisis based on results from tests that experts say can't be trusted. So there's that. But let's stipulate that improvement is possible. Instead of putting the load on teachers, why not figure out how to improve our learners? Spread the responsibility around. I didn't pay attention in school. Why? Because I couldn't see how it would benefit me. Sure, there was the abstract, good grades will get you into a good college, but that wasn't motivating. A good college costs a lot of money, and it takes forever to pay for. And it doesn't guarantee a job. And how many parents short-circuit the educational process with comments like, I haven't used algebra once since I got out of school, which sends the message, you're being forced to learn a lot of dumb stuff that isn't helpful or relevant. And because it bugs me, I want to address the algebra idiocy. Mathematics and other components of general education provide building blocks, i.e. options, to pursue advanced learning paths later. Even if specialized paths aren't chosen, the discipline of learning basic concepts builds critical thinking skills, which are infinitely transferable. And look at the furor over Common Core curricula. Parents who complain that Common Core should be ditched because they can't help their kids with homework send the message that complex material should be dumbed down. I want our kids wrestling with advanced concepts. If I don't understand the material, it's my problem, not theirs. So how do we motivate students? Most can't see 15 or 20 years down the road. I couldn't. We need to set short-term goals that are part of a clear roadmap of how education contributes to a better life. Not just when you're grown, but now, and 2 weeks from now, and 3 months from now. Career days are good, but careers are impossibly distant. My daughter wants to be a professional stage manager, but I struggle to make her understand how learning global history and Latin will impact that goal. And the news is filled with stories about downsizing and layoffs. Education needs to be more than just so you can get a job and be part of the economy. It's about participation in the community. It's about appreciating art and beauty, having a tool set to make better choices. Real motivation is whatever helps students understand that education matters even now. Don't trust Governor Cuomo, political magician. He has an agenda, and he's using misdirection to fool you. If you think public school teachers aren't effective, first ask yourself, why not? Use your math skills, set up the problem. Does the governor's assessment and proposed solution really make sense? Think about the teachers you've had. Are you the sum total of what they've crammed into your head? I suspect you can't think of many ineffective teachers. And if there are a few, what profession doesn't have duds? Do we really want to subject our kids and the entire public education system to ever-increasing testing just to weed out a few? Take a step back and let's figure out a better way. West Avenue School in Fairport, New York, was once a high school. The building resembled a castle. Turrets at each corner, stone-faced, ancient. Inefficient to maintain, it would eventually be gentrified to house senior citizens. But in 1979, a 10-year-old boy attended fifth grade on the third floor. High ceilings, heavy wooden doors, stairwells that echoed with ghost voices. Old wooden auditorium seats, balcony, creaking stage and immense musty curtain windows. Tiny library, tiny lunchroom, two tiny gyms like racquetball courts, death zones for bespectacled 10-year-old boys. And somewhere in that basement, between the gyms, a music room. Wondrous, magical cavern. Mrs. Z played Pink Floyd alongside Mozart, Boston, and Brahms. Carole King sang You've Got a Friend at the end of every class. Select choir met before school, before dawn, but the boy tracked a half mile through the dark gladly. He would sing a solo in the Christmas concert, soprano. 35 years later, he would remember every note, every word, long after his voice changed, long after the heartbreak. Because he was in love. And she was pregnant. The night of the concert, fairy tale snow dusted the turrets. He arrived early, tiptoed down to the cavern between the gyms, and positioned his masterpiece on her desk. A 6-page letter, bursting with every emotion a 10-year-old boy might imagine, and heedlessly confessed to his muse, elementary school teacher and mother-to-be. That evening, he sang the greatest solo he would ever sing, secretly dedicating it to her, along with the closing song, of course, You've Got a Friend. She cried as he sang, surely touched by the purity of his tone, his love, his devotion.
You just call out my
that night, sleepless with anticipation. The next day, a substitute taught the class. No rock music, no Carole King. The sub stayed the rest of the year, and the boy attended a different school after that, nothing like a castle. Mrs. Z returned once after the snow with her baby. He knew she was there, but he didn't say hello. You can find more essays and criticism at mossislandsounds.com. We're on Facebook and Twitter as Moss Island, all one word. Email me at chris.board@mac.com. Thank you for listening. Until next time. The original writing from the Moss Island Sounds podcast is owned by Chris Board and Moss Island Sounds. Copyright 2015. Unauthorized use and or duplication of this material without express and written permission from Chris Board is strictly prohibited. Excerpts and links may be used provided that full and clear credit is given to Chris Board and Moss Island Sounds with appropriate and specific direction to the original content.